The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war.
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell. Today, Veterans Chronicles host Gene Pell talks with Jake McNeese, an original member of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division of the United States Army. During the invasion of Normandy, they successfully blew out bridges to prevent German reinforcements from reaching the front lines. Before the Battle of the Bulge, they were dropped deep in France to perform reconnaissance work. And now, Gene Pell of Veterans Chronicles.
I always like to start these conversations by asking you to tell our audience something about yourself, where you grew up, what were the early influences that shaped your life?
I grew up in Maysville, Oklahoma. That's in south central Oklahoma in a farm community. And that also is the hometown of the famous aviator Wally Post. I saw Wally when I was a young boy, just 10, 12 years old, make parachute jump after parachute jump in my father's cotton patches. We were a large family, five boys, five girls, and we were farm folk. And we grew up in the Depression, the sand, the dust storms, the Depression of the late 20s, and then the Dust Bowl, and then off to war. And so I had a pretty frugal life until I went into the service in 1942.
What prompted you to do that?
I was, at that time, I was working with the War Department, building bomb storage arsenal buildings and the shipyards down in Houston, Texas. And I had total exemption from all draft purposes. But when Pearl Harbor came along, after Pearl Harbor came along, I was 23 years old at that time, and I wanted to become involved and do what I could, make any contribution I could after Pearl Harbor, when it really got serious and war was declared. So I volunteered in 1942 on September the 2nd.
Where did you go then?
I went straight into parachute duty. I went to Oklahoma City and volunteered and asked for parachute training. I trained with the 506th Parachute Regiment, the first parachute regiment the United States ever had to train as a regiment, and we were later assigned to the 101st Airborne Division, and I completed my training here in the States and made my five qualifying jumps. It's voluntary in the paratroop service until you have made five jumps, and then you become a qualified paratrooper, and there's no way out then but to just either be successful and live or to be unsuccessful and die. And so the two options weren't very good, and I selected the one to remain alive and stay with it, and I served with the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment from September the 2nd until in February of 1946.
Your book has some remarkable tales in it, but I must say the most remarkable thing I found out in reading the book was how in the world did you ever stay out of the stockade at Leavenworth?
I was in the stockade a number of times. In fact, when I was separated from the service, they were trying to get all of us veterans to re-enlist, you know. But at that time, they were giving $100 cash as you left, and then it made you $100 a month for 2 months, $300. And I kept telling this captain that was trying to get me to sign over and stay in the service to just give me my $300 and I'd get out of there. I was through with it. I didn't want to know part of the military. And he said, McNeese, he said, you know, he said, this $300 is awarded on comparison of good time versus bad time. He said, when you're AWOL, or when you're in the stockade, or when you're under arrest of quarters or extra duty, he says that's considered bad time as compared to garrison or combat, which is good time. And he said, I think that you may owe us some money. He says, I think you have more bad time than you've got good time.
They let you out then, huh?
Yeah, they let me out. And I have on my discharge papers a fact that I was awarded the Good Conduct Medal. And my wife read that, and she said, how in the world did you ever get a Good Conduct Medal with the way you soldiered? And I said, the captain that was handing out those awards when I came through the line, I said, he was rather hesitant. And I told him, give me one or I'll kill you. And I said, he gave me the award right away. Oh, I had a great time. I soldiered well, but I used all the rest of the time to my enjoyment and my ability to have fun.
Well, you really were a rebel in those days, and the book is filled with tales of bars and brawls, and you had certainly an irreverent or an unusual, let's put it that way, attitude toward superiors, particularly some of them in the officer corps. You just sort of went your own way, it seems to me, a lot of the time.
I went in only for one purpose, and that was to fight a war and get it over with if I could be successful, you know. And I didn't go for that malarkey of saluting officers or shining shoes and shaving unless I was getting ready to go in town and chase women. And I went in town anytime I got ready. I didn't wait for a pass or a furlough of any kind. They gave me, when I came out of Holland, I had fought up there for 78 days. Without a resupply or anything, you know. And they gave me a 72-hour pass as my reward for the 78 days. That wasn't even an hour per day, you know. I thought they'd made a mistake, so I took 10 more days and stayed AWOL that long. And came back. But they did respect my ability as a sergeant of availability, and so consequently they would put me in the stockade momentarily, but they would then release me as quick as they needed me, and I knew they would, and so I didn't pay much attention to whatever they wanted out of me, other than that I tried to train and absorb everything that I could that would be beneficial to conducting a serviceable attitude in combat.
Now, you went in as a private, and 3-4 years later, you came out as a private. You never even made private first class, right?
I went in as a buck private. At that time, the pay was only $21 a month. And after you were in there 30 days, they usually promoted you to a PFC, private first class. And that increased your salary to $31 a month. And, you know, times were still pretty tough back then. And they figured that would permit you to send an allotment of $5 or so home to your wife or your mother or dad or whoever needed it. And after 31 days, I was still a buck private. And I stayed in one company, Regimental Headquarters Company, for 3 years and 5 months and 26 days, and I never made PFC. I was always a sergeant in charge of groups of men from 30 on up to 180. I was a ranking sergeant in that, acting sergeant, you know.
Well, in the book, you come across, actually, is quite proud of the fact that you went in as a buck private and came out as one.
Yeah, I didn't want any rank. I didn't want any rank at all. I was glad not to be classified or suspiciously associated with officers or non-commissioned officers. I had very little respect. We had some very good officers. We had a lot of West Point men that was in parachute duty, and they were good men, and I respected them. I didn't show them any more courtesy than I thought I was entitled to, but I never wanted to be anything but a buck private.
The demolition unit to which you were assigned. What kind of special training did that require?
I had been, like I said, I had been in construction for a number of years with the War Department and with my own personal surveillance. But I knew quite a bit about tensile strengths of concrete and steel and different constructions and bridges and that sort of thing. So they immediately were happy for me to be in a demolition platoon, which primary purpose was to destroy communication lines and highways and bridges and ammunition depots and that sort of thing with explosives, and I was familiar with the strength of explosives. So consequently, it was kind of a suicidal deal. They were always drawing assignments that were quite dangerous, which I didn't avoid. You know, I volunteered for most of the assignments that contained a great deal of danger because I knew that in so doing, I would have the best men and the best soldiers that was available.
Well, it doesn't get much more dangerous than parachuting behind Nazi lines on this 6th day of June. Tell us about that experience.
I was assigned the 3rd Battalion Demolition Section, which was Sergeant Davidson, had an assignment of blowing up two bridges and maintaining control of the 3rd bridge. And I was in the 1st Battalion Section, and they asked me if I would volunteer to take his assignment, which I did. And when I did, my men decided they would go with me on the same deal. And there's usually 13 men in a demolition section or stick. And I told them that I would need at least 6 more men in order to accomplish what they were asking me to do. And so they gave me 6 more men, and I took 20 men in to Normandy instead of 13.
Coming up, McNeese tells the story of what happened next on this dangerous mission.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are
through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org
and click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast,
now online
at radioamerica.org.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out, get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
Let the ammunition and reload.
We cheer for Harlem on parade.
And now back to Gene Pell as he talks with Jake McNeese, the famed leader of the World War II unit known as the Filthy 13.
By daybreak, of course, we jumped in, and we had our plane lost a lot of altitude, and we had to bail out about 8 miles from where we originally were assigned for the bridges, you know. And by the time I got to the bridges, I was down to 2 men. It is pretty heavy, and I was down to 2 demolition men out of my stick. But we blew up the 2 bridges that we were assigned to, and we were holding the 3rd bridge, and I had accomplished what they wanted me to do, but I had no communication with my unit, and so I couldn't tell them what the situation was. Well, by the 3rd day, they determined, or they assumed, that we had been wiped out and that the 3rd bridge that we were supposed to be controlling was back in enemy hands by then. So they sent in 4 P-51 fighter bombers and knocked the bridge out from under us, and the Germans were on one end of the bridge and we were on the other end. So they split up then, and 2 of them took the Germans and 2 of them took us, and all destroyed us along with the bridges. But it was a pretty important mission that needed to be taken care of. and we were successful in it.
Well, from there, you fought inland, moving with the invasion force, and were there for a good part of the Normandy campaign. And then let's move on to Operation Market Garden. I've always thought that it didn't get the attention that it deserved, and I suppose it's because D-Day got so much attention. But that was 78 days of pretty rough going, too, wasn't it?
It was tough, tough going up there. We, when they surveyed the unit with their British intelligence, that was under the British Second Army, really is what it was, and General of the Airborne Service. But a major was running the intelligence on it and researching the operation, and he said it wouldn't work. He told them not to try it, that it was impossible. But they ignored his advice and went ahead with plans to go ahead and make an attempt on it. It would have been a good plan if it had been successful, but the 101st Airborne jumped in at Eindhoven, Holland, and we took all the bridges there over the Wilhelmina Canal and took charge of the highway, which was 25 miles between there and Veckel, where the 82nd jumped in at Nijmegen, and it took them 6 days to accomplish their objective, which was what they were allotted. But the British Red Devils and the Polak paratroopers, which formed a group of around 21,000 men, jumped it in Einheim, Germany, on the Rhine River, the major Rhine River, and they were supposed to secure the highway there and the river crossings, the bridges. They made a total fiasco of their operation. Out of the 21,000 that jumped in, only about 1,000 got out, and they never did secure the bridges or the waterways or the roads there in Arnhem, Germany. So that created a great stalemate to the deal, and instead of it being a quick thrust through the German forces, well, it turned out to be a total flop, and we fought there for 78 days trying to correct it. We lost about 70% there, the same amount of people that we had lost in Normandy. The average lifetime of a combat paratrooper in World War II was only 1.5 jumps. You didn't last very long. And out of the 50,000 men that were involved in the 101st Airborne from start to finish, there was only two of us that survived four combat jumps. George Blaine and I did, which was real, real unusual. But the Market Garden was a total failure from word go. And the major, the British major that gave them advice not to attempt it, he committed suicide after it became such a failure.
Well, you went from there into an even worse situation. You've been fighting there 78 days. You come out, you took some authorized and some authorized leave, and the next thing you know, you're in effect saddling up again and heading back into a place called Bastogne, which at the time was completely surrounded by German army and panzer divisions. And you went in with totally unprepared, in my opinion, based on the fact that you didn't have the right winter clothing, you didn't have any ammunition, you didn't have any weapons even, you didn't have any food supplies, nothing just about. And here you are dropped in the middle of a circle that the circumference of which is comprised of German enemy troops.
When I came out of Holland, I went AWOL for a while there, and they came around and they had a group of paratroopers that they called Pathfinders.
Coming up, McNeese describes the cities he visited in Europe during the war, a special visit from General Eisenhower, and his time after the war.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Now back to Gene Pell as he talks with Jake McNeese, the famed leader of the World War II unit known as the Filthy 13.
And they jumped anywhere at any time for anybody that had a plausible cause. And it was strictly all volunteer because of the high rate of casualty, which ran 80 to 90% on most of their jumps. Why, they couldn't assign you to it. It had to be volunteer service. And they asked me, of course, when the officers wanted to get anyone killed, they would try to make it attractive for them to go into volunteer for pathfinding service, which I did. I volunteered for it when they asked me. It looked like a good deal, really. The war, for all practical purposes, looked like it was almost over. And I thought they never will use pathfinders again. And they were stationed at Shaw Grove, England, which was only 8 miles away from Oxford University. And I thought there's more women and more whiskey there and less fighting than anywhere in Europe. I'd be stupid not to volunteer. So I did. I volunteered. And when men in the unit found out that I had volunteered, five more and one officer went with me. And so we were sitting there in jolly old England when the Battle of the Bulge broke loose on December the 16th. And they made a quick thrust through. They had 20 divisions attacking the American front. And the Americans were in absolute utter disarray and were retreating out of there as quickly and as fast as they could, three divisions of them. And the 101st was loaded up into trucks at midnight on December the 17th and run into Bastogne with orders. There was 20,000 of them in a division, and they were given orders not to retreat an inch and not to surrender a man, just fight till everybody was dead. The town of Bastogne was a major network of highways. It was seven highways and three rail lines coming through, and it had had good communication set up. And the Germans needed it. Well, they absolutely had to have it in order to complete and make a success out of the Battle of the Bulge, which they were trying to drive through Belgium and Luxembourg and France, Antwerp, and take over the harbors there. And they had to have the city of Bastogne to be able to do it. So as the 101st was moving in and the three divisions were pulling out, the people pulling out told them, said, you better turn around and get your ass out of here because if you don't, you'll be surrounded in a very short time. And I said, good, that's the way we like to fight, is to be surrounded and outnumbered. So they moved on in and took up positions around and in Bastogne to hold it. By December the 22nd, the weather was terrible. It was 22 degrees below zero, heavy snow and sleet and ice, and it was impossible to supply the men in Bastogne except by aerial drop. By parachute of the equipment they needed. They were out of medicine. They were down to 10 rounds of ammunition per gun. They had little or no food. It was a terrible condition. They didn't have the proper clothing for the weather. And they decided that they would try to set up aerial resupply involving pathfinders. I took 20 men into Bastogne and dropped in there. They had 1,000 C-47s loaded with supplies that we needed to continue to hold Bastogne. And they were circling in the air over France waiting to see if I could get a signal to them that they could guide in on through this inclement weather. I got my equipment in, got my men down, got set up, and by 12 o'clock I had C-47s coming in there like a swarm of bees, dropping equipment. We were successful in holding Bastogne. And they had 7 divisions attacked on the perimeter of Bastogne. They had 4 infantry divisions, 3 infantry divisions, 1 parachute division, and 4 armored divisions, 3 armored divisions. In other words, we was outmanned about 50-1 is about what it amounted to. But we continued to keep them out of there until Patton broke through with the 4th Division, Armored Division, on December the 26th. And we were very successful in it. They were proud of the efforts of the 101st Airborne there. In fact, General Eisenhower flew into Bastogne when things were safe, and he awarded the Presidential Unit Citation to the division as a whole. The only time it had ever been done in the military, and it has never been done since. We suffered heavy casualties there, probably close to 70% again, but it was a very successful operation. They were a very famous group of people. They didn't get much notoriety. It was really, really top secret equipment that was designed by the Air Force. It had 2 buttons on it. It was about the size of a shoebox. It wasn't very big. It was about CRN-4 sets was the name of the equipment we used to guide them in with. And it had 2 buttons on it. And the button that would discharge the signal that they could pick up and guide on, you pressed every 30 seconds. But if you became wounded or you were going to be overrun where that set might fall into the hands of German intelligence where they could analyze it and dissect it and everything. Well, it had a second button on it, and you would press it. It was a destruct button, and it would blow the set up and kill you. So the Pathfinders did not get a lot of publicity.
Well, certainly not as much as the E Company did in the Band of Brothers, that's for sure. But after Bastogne, how much longer were you in?
Well, I was in from Bastogne. Bastogne was in December of 44, and I stayed in until I went in. I made another jump after Bastogne. I jumped on the Siegfried Line down at Prüm, Germany,
right,
for the 90th Division. And then I came out of there and went back to my original unit, the 501st. Regimental Headquarters, 506 Regimental Headquarters Company, and as we made our cruise down through southern Germany and Austria, where we took over Königssee there, hit Göring's big castle and everything, and stole all his race horses, and then we went on down, took over Berchtesgaden, which was Hitler's eagle's nest at Berchtesgaden, Austria. And we were used as occupation troops until in the early part of May, the 8th, was the E-Day. That's when victory in Europe declared. And they began to rotate soldiers home at that time. And it was on a point system. If you had 85 points, which you were gained through weapons and wounds and this and that, you got 5 points for every time you shot. You got 5 points for every combat jump you made. And they had a deal made up. and nearly all the paratroopers had plenty of points to get out. But at that time, Franklin D. Roosevelt had died, and Eleanor was still alive there in Washington, D.C., and she still was swinging a pretty heavy stick up there and had a lot of influence, and she went to the War Department and to Congress, and she said the way that paratroopers were trained and everything and the way they were used in combat, they're professional killers, and said we can't bring them home and turn them loose on society with the attitude they have. They'll have to be put in special camps and deprogrammed and got ready to for civilian life. But they went ahead and started discharging us. But I was supposed to come home on September the 12th. On September the 12th, I was supposed to come home, and I didn't think I'd ever get back over to see Paris again. So on the 11th, I decided I'd go in and do Paris one more time, and I got in town there and got on a big drunk and got cut up in a street brawl, and I was in hospitals from then on until February of 1946. And that was the rest of my service.
Mm-hmm. Well, after you left the service, you knocked about the country in various jobs for a while, and again, getting into trouble with the law and bars and brawls, changed all of that?
Well, when I came home, of course, I was an alcoholic, you know, and I was in every jail from Rome to Nome and Maine to Spain, not for any criminal charges, just drunken brawls and that sort of thing. But I came home on a vacation, or I came back to Ponca City just to visit, as I was going to go to work down Lake Charles, Louisiana, with a refinery. I had a few days there in between. I came through Ponca City, and I met a young lady from Brooklyn. She was half Italian and half Hebrew, and I married her, and she took quite a bit of the rough edges off of me, but she died in about 3.5 years. And In the meantime, I had gone to work for the Postal Department here in Ponca City, Oklahoma, and after my wife died about a year later, I met a wonderful lady from Texas, mother of one little child, 15 months old, and she and I married, and she was a fine Christian lady, and she said we just had to give up on the drinking end of it and carousing around and brawling and joints and so forth, and we've had 54 years of beautiful life. Raised 3 children, her boy, and then we had 2 of our own children.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been very successful. They're all our college graduates, and they're CEOs and that sort of thing, and professors in colleges, and we've been blessed very much.
Mm-hmm. You said a minute ago that one of the reasons you went up to Paris on the day before you were supposed to ship out for home was that you thought you'd never see it again, but have you been back to visit these places where you fought?
Oh, yeah. Martha and I have been back together in Europe 5 times, and I've been back 6 times, and I have in the last 5 or 6 years, and I have actually gone in Bastogne, where we were fighting. There was the little town of Foy,
mm-hmm.
and it had a good elevation of land, and whoever controlled it had a lot of advantages, and we fought and took Foy 4 times. We'd take it, and they'd kick us out. We'd kick them out, and they'd kick us out. It changed hands 4 times, and I went there last year and went out in the forest that surrounds it there, the Harlequin Forest, and the foxholes are still there that we fought out of. And I visited when we were in Bastogne also a couple of years ago. I had an opportunity, I think the story's in the book, I'm not sure, about taking over the little farmhouse and the 2 ladies and the little boy, 14 years old, showing up and wanting to come in. And I told the ladies they could come in and they wouldn't be molested, they'd be treated like ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't kill the little boy, I'd let him live. And when we were back over there a couple of years ago in Baston, I met that little boy. He's 74 years old now.
Hmm.
And he's president of the biggest bank in Baston.
Wow.
So it's been interesting to go back, you know, and meet individuals that you had personal dealings with.
Up next in our Profiles in Valor segment, host Tim Hulbert of the American Veterans Center speaks with Silver Star recipient Specialist Jeremiah Church, United States Army, about his service as a reconnaissance platoon machine gunner during combat operations on August 8, 2007, in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
This is Tim Hulbert from the American Veterans Center, inviting you to join us for our upcoming 12th annual conference, November 12th through the 14th in Washington, D.C. The conference is your opportunity to meet some of America's greatest military heroes from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan, hearing their stories of valor firsthand. Confirmed participants include General David Petraeus, commander of CENTCOM, Air Force Colonel and retired astronaut Buzz Aldrin, several of the Band of Brothers from World War II, Baseball Hall of Famer and World War II vet Bob Feller, Dutch Van Kirk, navigator of the Enola Gay, recipients of the Medal of Honor, veterans portrayed in the film Black Hawk Down, decorated heroes from today's military, and much, much more. Conference attendees are also invited to exclusive receptions, including one honoring our wounded warriors currently recovering at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. To request a full schedule or registration form, visit our website at www.AmericanVeteransCenter.org. Call 703-302-1012, extension 220, or email avc@AmericanVeteransCenter.org. That's avc@AmericanVeteransCenter.org. Spend Veterans Day weekend in the company of heroes.